times, Harold Baines was on first.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Blitner. To my left is co-host Daniel Green. And in case you didn't catch our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is Outside the Studio. So for the next 57 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports tapes. Before we get into today's show, though, we'd like to express our congratulations to special guest co-host Walt Bonet for getting engaged last weekend. Walt and Ariana have been together for a while now, and we're so happy for the two of them, and we hope to have Walt back in a couple of weeks so we can hear all about it.
We'd also like to wish New York Post Hockey Hall of Fame writer Larry Brooks, also a friend of the show, a happy birthday as well.
And we will be joined in just a minute by Chris Carlin of ESPN Radio, who will be coming on to talk all about sports. And it's going to be a hot topic, a great show. And we're also going to get to talk with a Hall of Fame basketball writer on the eve of March Madness. So let's see if we can get Chris connected in now.
I'm really excited for this interview with Chris Carlin.
I'm here.
Hi, Chris. It's Matthew and Dan outside the studio. How are you?
Good, Matthew. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us here. We're going to get things kick-started. We know that you were a big part of New York Mets coverage for a number of years. So what's your take with spring training underway on a team from Queens?
You know, I don't know what to think yet. I'm definitely more optimistic than I have been in years, and I think with good reason. I think a lot of fans should be. And, you know, I think what's really kind of bothered me more than anything is that they have taken some massive steps with new ownership here. And a lot of fans have not been happy with the fact that they didn't go out and get George Springer or Real Muto or Trevor Bauer and wanted more and more and more. And I, you know, the Mets are considerably better today than they were last year. I don't think there's any question, and they're absolutely contenders, but I very much am of the belief that they are right there with the Braves. I just want to see how healthy they're going to stay, and I want to see how their bullpen is going to play out. And if Edwin Diaz is going to be the closer and he's supposed to be the answer, I don't want to know what the question is.
Oh, boy. And beyond just Edwin Diaz, you did touch about the bullpen. You know, Dylan Betances is also in that bullpen. Aaron Loop, of course, who was a signee, is in that bullpen. Beyond the closer, who I know that Sabermetrics are trying to get away from the ninth inning strictly role, but beyond him, who would you say is the most important pitcher in the Mets bullpen for this season? Because they still have to get to Diaz.
Well, and he's banged up, but it's Seth Lugo to me. I mean, I just think that he's such a valuable piece and commodity to have, especially with the way things are these days with how they play with analytics. And I just think, first of all, you know, it's absurd for numbers to be able to suggest how a guy's going to handle a ninth inning situation and try to put that in the same vein as any other inning. It's just not. How many times have we seen closers that have come into games where they're either losing or it's a tie game and they don't have the edge to it? There's not a way to quantify that. I think that Lugo is somebody that, you know, if the Mets have him healthy, then he is someone that a lot of teams don't have, a guy that can give you, you know, two and three innings on a night. You may not have him every night, but he can be more than a bridge guy. He can get some big outs when you need him, and he can also give you some length when you need it.
And Chris, I completely agree with that. Seth Lugo is somebody that we've become accustomed to for a long time and will clearly be a big key. In terms of some of the acquisitions that the Mets have made, what do you see as a reasonable expectation for some of the new guys, primarily Carrasco and Francisco Lindor?
You know, Lindor, I expect him to be back to what he was in 2019. He obviously didn't have a great 2020, but I really take anything that happened, good or bad, this past year, unless it's somebody that was continuing to play at a consistent level as they have throughout their career, and throw it out the window. I would expect Lindor to be back to what he was a couple of years ago. You know, to me, that's hitting, you know, 280, 290. That's hitting 25 homers. That's driving in 85, 90 runs and playing an outstanding shortstop. You know, I think with, you know, James McCann, I don't know what to expect offensively, because he has gotten better, but this is a guy that a couple of years ago was not really well thought of, and if I'm not mistaken, got DFA'd at one point. I think he's, as long as he is much better with the pitching staff, I think you're going to be in pretty good shape. Carrasco, I love, because I just think he helps. You know, I just think he helps the depth factor. I love what they've done to improve their depth. It doesn't get talked about enough, not just the rotation, but the team overall. Everybody wanted to see so many of the stars come in, right? But the Mets, over the last 10, 12, 13 years, when they have lost guys, they are replacing them with guys that, you know, you could question whether or not they should be on a major league roster. And that's not the case anymore. Like, you have actual depth on this bench. And to me, if you lose anybody like that, and Carrasco on a, you know, middle to back end of the rotation, the things they've done to really shore things up in that regard, to add options, I love the way they have gone about that aspect of it.
Now, Chris, you mentioned a lot in there about how, you know, players, especially Lindor and other players, need to get back to what they were. Obviously, last year was just a weird year overall. There's just so many things that happened last year that it can't be counted as a real year for the most part in a lot of things, outside the Dodgers winning the World Series, because no one can take that away from them. But we had a caller last week who brought a hot take that 8 of the 10 New York sports teams, were including Buffalo for the Sabres and the Bills here, that they will make the playoffs in the 2021-2022 season. The lone exceptions to miss the playoffs will be the Jets and the Sabres, according to our caller last week. And so basically the caller is saying that all the sports teams in New York can get back to what they do well, which we all know New York has a lot of pride in winning. What's your take on this very radical idea?
I'm skeptical. First of all, I know they're in New York. I can't, you know, I don't think of the Bills when I think of New York.
They're in New York than the Jets and the Giants. They're in the actual state.
You know, I hate that argument. I hate that argument. I really do. I mean, honestly, if you went through the state of New York, how many people care about the Jets and the Giants versus care about the Bills? You know,
oh, absolutely. It's not even close.
Yeah. West of Syracuse, and even including Syracuse, it may be more Giants, but it's still west of Syracuse as the Bills. But at any rate, that aside, you know, so let's look at this. Are the Rangers? The Rangers have had a bad season. Are they going to make the playoffs?
Well, we're talking for next year, not this year.
Oh, next year.
Yeah, next year for all the teams to make the playoffs. Next year. Obviously, we know this year is a lost year when it comes to the Rangers and other
teams.
Yeah,
I would say, I think the Giants have to make the playoffs, and it's a massive disappointment if they don't. I don't expect the Jets to make the playoffs this coming year. I really don't. I think they'll take a massive step forward, but I think that would be asking probably a little bit too much in year one of Robert Saleh. You know, the rest of it I can't argue with. I really can't. I think the most intriguing to me is what plays out with the Knicks. When they have the ability to get talent, what does the talent look like? Who are they bringing in? That's what I want to see. how that happens, because I know a lot of people are fired up with what's going on right now. They're simply still not good enough yet. So I want to see who that star is that they're able to get there, or one of their young players, if they're going to develop into a star.
Now, Chris, staying with basketball, we would be remiss if we didn't ask you about Rutgers basketball and the job that Steve Peichel has done this year. What do you make of this team as somebody, obviously, who has a lot of experience around Rutgers basketball, and what do you think of what the job that the coaching has done?
Well, first of all, Steve Peichel's done an amazing job. He and his staff have been fantastic. And you know, to really be able to get to this level in the toughest basketball conference in the country is beyond impressive. I can't say enough about that. You know, they've been a little inconsistent this year at times, especially on the offensive end. The other night against Indiana, they seemed to get it together. You know, with the two games that they have left with Minnesota and Nebraska, you really the one that you cannot lose to Nebraska, but they haven't had a loss below quad one this year, and they have the fourth ranked strength of schedule in the country. I mean, if you had told me that in 2016, I would have laughed. You know, and it just, it really gives them all the credit. And I think the thing that you've seen the most is just the development of the talent. You know, you've seen Miles Johnson develop. You've seen Ron Harper Jr. develop into a player of the year candidate at the beginning of the season, to Geo Baker, who's just a big shot maker. I can't say enough about the development of these players, not just the recruiting, but these guys have all been guys that have been here for 4 years and really just become really, really good basketball players.
That's a great synopsis, Chris, of what's going on with Rutgers. I want to right now turn our attention to something that it got a bit of news the other day, and of course there'll be more news on it every 3 months, essentially, since, you know, the sports book that covers the ratings for, or the radio shows. And you've developed into, obviously, one of the bigger names in New York radio scene, and you've worked on both sides of the rivalry between ESPN and WFAN. And for you, since you've seen both sides of this, why don't you detail a little bit for us what this intense ratings battle between the two stations is, especially since there seems to be a conflict over how you can actually determine the winner.
Well, I mean, listen, I get both arguments about it. To me, it's, you know, Michael and Don and Peter have established themselves as the number one show in New York. You know, that's just a fact. And to me, Fan, I think, is, you know, they've got very smart people running it. Obviously, Craig's a very talented guy, and, you know, Evan knows how to do radio. I think it's, you know, I think rising tides kind of lift all boats. But, you know, Michael, Don, and Peter, to me, are just, they have hit an incredible stride and are really rolling right now. And I think, I also think in January and February, it's very difficult to try to grade sports radio, because they're probably the two worst sports months of the year. You know, things really heat up. That's why when you go and you talk about the important times of year, it's about the spring and it's about the fall. And those are the most important books to do well in. I fully expect, you know, Michael, Don, and Peter to continue to be number one, because they've established themselves that way. And the thing is, they show up to work every day, never taking that for granted. I give them all the credit in the world for it. It's been fun to watch from the other side of it, especially when, you know, it wasn't that long ago I was going up directly against them. And these are guys that I've been friends with for a really, really long time.
And now you're following them on
on the lineup. And I was friends with them when we were going up head to head. They're good people. They really are. And, you know, when I came over, they've been beyond incredibly welcoming and supportive. It's been a, it's been an awesome environment to work in, and you know, Rick and Dave and Chris in the mornings have been absolutely amazing. You know, I can't say enough about everyone at the station and how supportive they've been for me. And look, you know, sports radio to me is about the fans first and foremost. And I think when there is good sports radio in New York, as I know that we have it at ESPN, that you're going to absolutely benefit from that. And listen, Fan is the long time leader in it. And there's, you know, there's a good battle for it that everybody wins.
And it's wonderful to be able to hear you talk about it from both sides on that, and how you don't let personal affect professional and vice versa. Again, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with ESPN radio host Chris Collin. Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on Outside the Studio today. And we certainly wish you and the station a lot of luck going forward. And hopefully, maybe we'll even be competing with each other one day.
I appreciate it, guys. Not yet, okay? I don't want to lose my job yet.
We're not coming to take your job. We just want to compete.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was ESPN radio host Chris Collin. I'm going to go out and get our second host right now as Daniel introduces him for our listening audience.
This is the perfect time to have our next guest on. Dick Weiss is somebody who's been around college basketball for, I don't know, a billion years. This is somebody who has seen every single side of it. He's somebody who knows more about the tournament than anybody. And we've got a lot to talk about with the NCAA. Obviously, there is some news coming from the teams in New York. You just heard a little bit about Rutgers. We're going to have to discuss a lot of the stuff going on at Hofstra and Iona. And Dick Weiss is the best person to talk to about this. And overall, I know it's been a crazy year, and I know it's easy to forget about all of this, but March Madness is around the corner, and I think most people would agree that March Madness is one of the best events in sports, if not the best event in sports. So to be able to speak with Dick right now, he's going to give us some expert opinions on some of our favorite teams and what we might be looking at for this NCAA tournament. And hopefully we're going to get him plugged in right now.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back with Dick Weiss, the Hall of Fame basketball writer. Dick, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. It's nice talking to you guys.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us here. It's Matthew and Dan and Outside the Studio.
No problem, Matt and Dan. It's good to hear from you.
Absolutely. And one thing we want to get into, March Madness is right around the corner. You know, the month of March is starting in just a few weeks, in just a few days. The month of March is going to get kick-started. In your professional expertise, look, last year was crazy. March Madness was canceled. You know, the tournament was called off due to COVID. Some games in the conference tournament were, you know, they were called off midway through the game. It was an unheard of situation. So now that it's back this year, in your opinion, what is the level of excitement in the industry for this year's tournament, knowing how much it stands to gain after a year off?
Well, I think there's more excitement among the teams involved, guys, because of the money involved. I mean, they all have television contracts. And last year, where the NCAA would usually be doling out $600 million to these teams, the number was closer to $225. All these teams need the money in order to make their athletic programs run. So I think from that standpoint, people are really excited. Look, I wish this pandemic was over. I wish we could put in 75% capacity in the events out in Indianapolis, but it's not going to happen. So from a standpoint of fan excitement, I think fans have always been interested in the tournament, partly because a lot of them are in office pools, and partly because it's the one time a year that tends to capture the imagination of the American sports fan. I mean, the NCAA Final Four has probably become, maybe not as big as the Super Bowl, but it's in that classification right now. And for 3 weeks, everyone seems to be interested in it. Do I wish there were fans in the stands? Certainly more than 25% in Indianapolis? Yeah, and I'm sure everybody else does. There's something special about the end of a season and 70,000 people watching a national championship game. But I think people will still be excited. I think that the teams, particularly Gonzaga and Baylor and Michigan, have created enough excitement that people will tune in and watch.
And actually, that's one of the big questions going into this tournament. Is obviously Gonzaga has had an unbelievable season, and they're undefeated, but obviously the level of competition is much lower. This is the same thing they go through every year. Do you see them as a true number one, or after watching Michigan?
I do see them as a true number one based on the fact they've beaten West Virginia, who was a sleeper to get to the Final Four. They've beaten Iowa, who probably will be a two seed. I mean, they beat Kansas, who will probably be in the tournament. Their non-league wins are all very good. They've made it easy on themselves in their league season. One thing I would say is Gonzaga's had a lot of really good teams. This is the first Gonzaga team that I remember that has won 21 out of 22 games by double digits. It's the first Gonzaga team I remember that has three legitimate All-American candidates in Drew Timme, Jalen Suggs, and Corey Kispert. And I think that they have a coach who eventually is going to be in the Hall of Fame. Just remember, it wasn't all that long ago when they got to the NCAA Finals in 17.
It definitely wasn't all that long ago. Everyone remembers the, you know, Gonzaga going on that long run. For you, moving from Gonzaga, which conference tournaments that have yet to be played, obviously, which is, I believe, all of them, do you see as being the most key for determining seeding for a Selection Sunday?
I think that the Big Ten is going to be the most interesting, because they have a chance. Well, before last night, I thought they had a chance to get upwards to 9, maybe even 10 teams in the 68-team field. With Minnesota losing to Northwestern, I'm not quite sure that possibility existing. But they have a chance to be the first league ever to wind up with two number ones and two number twos. I mean, it's never happened before. And right now, even though Ohio State has lost two straight games, they are probably still hanging on to that fourth number one seed. And Iowa and Illinois are still getting a lot of push for number two seed in most bracketology.
And Rutgers as well. Rutgers is actually having some success, and they're going to be further down
there. Rutgers will probably be in the tournament for the first time since 1991.
They're doing dancing, hopefully.
And we're big fans of that.
Well, I think that they thought they were going to go dancing last year. I mean, last year they only lost one game at home. This year, not quite. They've run hot and cold, but the second half of their last game against Indiana was pretty impressive. They really shot it. They shot it well in the first half. I mean, Ron Harper and Geo Baker combined for 10 threes. I mean, when that happens, everything changes, because their team, when they don't make shots and they don't make threes, they really struggle. I mean, last year they learned how to win with defense and rebounding and the fact that they had 18 home games. This year they have a chance to get 10 wins in a league that is by far, in my mind, the deepest league in the country.
And you mentioned about how, you know, they did this all last year. It's another team that was going dancing last year for the first time in well over a decade in Hofstra. The tournament wasn't held, as we've already alluded to. Oh, do you see? What do you see from them this year, and can they get that repeat?
I feel bad. Joey Mihalik's a friend of mine, so that's been hard. I think that they, their interim coach Fairley stepped in and done a good job. But, you know, I'm waiting for more Northeast teams to win down, to win games and qualify for and qualify for the tournament. I mean, I thought Hofstra at least two or three times since 2006 had teams that were good enough to play in the NCAA tournament. I thought they should have been in the tournament, believe it or not, in 2006, the year that George Mason got the second bid and ended up going to the Final Four. I mean, Hofstra beat them twice during the regular season. I thought they were just a terrific team. And look, they have become a school that has become more and more attractive to kids on the island. And I think as long as that continues, they're always going to get one or two players that probably could play on a slightly higher level that end up in the CAA.
And that's sometimes all it takes from a college basketball perspective is
Absolutely.
Getting those one or two players. And the guy who is seen as the consensus number one this year, Cade Cunningham, what have you seen out of him?
I think he reminds me a lot of people want to make him Magic. He's not Magic, but he does remind me a lot of Grant Hill. And the fact he's got the size at the next level to play small forward or a point forward. I mean, I like the fact that he can, that he's a 6'8" point guard. I like the fact that he can lift a team on his shoulders, and it looks like if they don't settle the appeal, that Oklahoma State may have a chance to play in the tournament, and that would be great for him. I mean, there's a bunch of kids. Like, I think Jalen Suggs is the second coming of Jason Kidd. I think he's a great player. I think that Evan Mobley has got a legitimate big-time skills for a 6'10 freshman. I mean, and I think Jonathan Kuminga, the kid who played at Patrick's school last year and is playing in the G League right now, has a legitimate shot at being the number one pick. So I'm not quite sure that we're locked into making Cade Cunningham number one yet, but he certainly will be under consideration. A lot will probably depend on his individual workout.
You mentioned a lot of players right there, but as we know, and it's very cliche, there's no I in team. So for all the hopefuls, who do you see as making that Cinderella-type run, and who maybe could even be like that sleeper that you don't, you know, people are not really high on them, but look out, because here they come.
I think West Virginia, I mean, has a chance to get the Final Four this year, and I say that even though they lost their starting center, who transferred out of school and went to Kentucky in mid-semester. I mean, Bobby Huggins has changed his entire style of play. He's now playing four out and using Culver as his inside player. He has got three legitimate three-point shooters, a lot like Oklahoma does. I like this West Virginia team. They always play hard. I think Deuce McBride will be an All-American before he graduates. Sean McNeil has shot the ball very well from the three. And Derek Culver is good to go for a double-double anytime he plays. They're the type of team that can score over 80. They're the one team that caused Gonzaga problems until late in the game, early on. I think they're the type of team that really could create a problem if they get in the tournament. I mean, as far as the Big Ten is concerned, if I knew that Io DeSumo was healthy and was definitely not going to be bothered by a broken nose, I would think that Illinois might have a chance to go pretty far, too. I'm not sure if you're going to have a team that is fifth or sixth this year, because I think a lot of those teams this year are younger teams that may not have the experience level that you need to advance into March. And I think that experience is probably the most important thing right now in this tournament, because there's been so many starts and stops, so many games that have been postponed or canceled. And I think that you need a team that has a feel for each other, a team like Michigan, that you can just throw out there and you don't lose a beat, even if you add a freshman.
And with that being said, with all the craziness this year, what do you see as the Final Four if you had to pick today?
Oh, I think, you know, I'm a sucker for number ones. Although I do think that Florida State will get there. I do think that I think Michigan gets there. I'm not sure. I mean, I would like to tell you Gonzaga gets there because they're going to be the number one overall seed. I don't know. Baylor's playing well right now, but you know, it's a one and done world out there. It's not like we're dealing with best of seven. One bad game could lock you up. I mean, we all saw Baylor had to go to the wire to win the other night. I mean, nobody's really pushed Gonzaga, although they weren't a 2-point game against Santa Clara last night. But, you know, I mean, I think those are the teams that probably have the most strengths at every position. And I think that that's the most important thing this year.
You're talking about, you know, not wanting to lock anyone in, and obviously we can't do that yet because we don't even know the field, per se. But who we're going to ask you to lock in right now, your pick, who is winning the men's March Madness championship on April 5th this year? Lock it in right now. You have, this is it. Who is winning this year?
I don't know. I'll pick Michigan.
Michigan. All right. Well, if any of you from Michigan are out there listening right now, you have a pretty good vote of confidence from a Hall of Fame writer and Dick Weiss. Dick, thank you so much for joining us here.
Okay, guys, listen, it's so nice talking to both of you. Best of luck with your show.
Thank you, and you know, we'll be rooting for your picks to come through.
You know what? I just hope it's going to be a fun march.
We need it. We definitely need it.
We all need it, pal.
Yeah. All right. And thank you, Dick. And
all right, guys.
We'll talk to you later. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Hall of Fame basketball writer Dick Weiss. And we are now going to, before we get into several New York sports situations, there are a couple shout-outs we want to give to our friends Brianna and Michelle at Enter the Playground NYC as they work to revitalize the music scene in our city. And also, because we're getting messages from our special guest co-host, who evidently didn't like having his engagement announcement coupled with other things, we're going to again say congratulations to Walt and Ariana on their engagement. Can you believe that, Dan? He's not even here today, and he wants extra time.
He's such a diva. I can't wait to have him back and rip him for this.
Absolutely. But now we're going to get into, it's a rather serious situation, the New York Rangers star left winger Artemi Panarin. For those of you who have not been living under a rock this past week, he has been forced to take a leave of absence, not because of COVID, not because of injury, but because he spoke out against the Russian government on more than one occasion, and his former Russian coach is alleging, so far absolutely no one backs this up, by the way, alleging that he beat an 18-year-old girl back in 2011 when Panarin was roughly 19 years old. This is completely politically motivated. Five of Panarin's former KHL teammates have since come out saying that they have no recollection of this. The KHL has said that there's no record of this incident. The Latvian police say that there's no record of this incident. The hotel that it supposedly happened at says that there's no record of this incident. And all this is doing is causing Panarin and his family a lot of grief. And I know we don't generally talk about these type of serious gravity situations, but we're going to get into that right now.
I mean, if this person, if Panarin has the courage to go up against the Russian Kremlin, then we should have the courage to discuss this situation and get outside of our comfort zone. This is a classic case of compromise. That's all this is. It is politically motivated as blackmail. It is a fabricated story from all appearances of it. This is not uncommon from coming out of Russia. And what is uncommon is that Panarin is the highest profile athlete to speak out this severely against Vladimir Putin. And I want to talk about him because, yes, it's very easy to get cynical about politics, to get cynical about the world, to feel helpless in a situation where this is a dictatorship that continues to do bad behavior and continues to get away with it. But I want to talk about the courage of this man right here. Because you want to see the damaging effect that kompromat can have? Ask Boris Nemtsov. Ask the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. This is something where it's not just you that's at risk. It's your family. And this is somebody who's 29. He's 29 years old, and he understands the risk that he's taking on. He understands what this means. And yet, he's not doing it because it's easy. He's not doing it because he feels this way. He's doing it because it's right. And that's somebody that I'm proud to have representing my favorite team, the New York Rangers.
And look, Panarin, he is an absolutely terrific athlete. As we all know, he finished third in the Hart Trophy voting last year. So that just shows what he can do on the ice. Off the ice, he's absolutely, there's plenty of testimonials about how good of a teammate he is and how good of a person he is away from the rink. So for him to have to go through this, it's not fair to him. It's not fair to his family. It's not fair to the New York Rangers. It's something that it really shouldn't be happening. We're in 2021 right now at this point, and we should be past this point of things in the world where some country and a person from halfway around the world can control what's going on. It really shouldn't, but we do want to support Panarin in his steadfast ability to try to handle this in his way and make sure that he is safe, his family is safe, and make sure that he himself feels that he can continue to use his star power to hopefully bring about positive change in the world.
And we love, obviously, bringing sports stories to you each week and talking about the Rangers and breaking it all down. But obviously, he's taken a leave of absence. He should take as much time as he needs. This is beyond sports. This is beyond everything. This is about this man's family.
That's absolutely right.
This is about his life. I mean, this is not something that should be taken lightly. And we just want to say we wholeheartedly support this man and hope that he can continue to fight the good fight.
And while he continues to fight the good fight away from the rink, the New York Rangers will be attempting to fight the good fight on the ice. Dan, I don't know that went so well.
No, it didn't. And again, just to show the impact that Panarin has, they have not gotten a point when he has not gotten a point in a game this season so far. So this
a lot more than just this season, believe me.
This is ripping out the heart of this team. And obviously, we understand why, as we've said, but this is something where you're taking out the leadership. Now, one thing I will say is Chris Kreider, who was, as we called it, invisible, as we said, Groundhog's Day. He's.
I don't know what word you're using. Those are all your words. Those are your words.
He hadn't seen his shadow, but after this week, we saw that he got the hat trick and that he came through and tried to take the team on his back.
For the record, we're talking about the game against Philadelphia the other night, ladies and gentlemen. For any of you who missed the game, the Rangers lost 4-3, and Kreider did indeed have his fourth career hat trick.
And put the team on his back, and put his team in a situation to win. Now, the issue overwhelmingly is, without Panarin, there's just not enough there. There's just not enough for this team to really make moves. But as David Quinn said, this is a chance to overcome adversity. Sports gives us a chance to overcome adversity, and we'll see what the Rangers can do, but no, I don't have great hope for them.
And look, a key, whether Panarin's on the ice or not, Mika Zibanejad needs to find himself. He doesn't have to go back to what he did last year. I am firmly of the belief that what he did last year with the 45 goals and 57 games was a complete, just absolute career year. Great to see, but it was a career year. I don't think that that's who Zibanejad is as a true player. I do not think he's a 45-goal-a-year guy or a 40-goal-a-year guy. I think 25 to 30 goals is where he is per year, and I believe the Rangers would take that. I don't know that they would take that for $10 million a year, potentially, when his contract is up, but they would sign up for that. Right now, Meek is not scoring, though. And not only is he not scoring, he's not contributing in any way on the ice.
And the team's going to need him. Guys are going to need to start to step up. And even if, as we've spoke with Chris Carlin about, maybe this is a lost season, maybe this is a season where there's just too much coming their way, you still need to see something out of him. You still need to see him improve and continue to bring this team into the next years going forward.
The positive news in a world of negativity with the Rangers is that Philip Hedl will most likely, well, there's no guarantees, there's no timetable, but most likely be back within the next 2 weeks, which Hedl had been the Rangers' best forward, arguably, before going down with an undisclosed upper body injury. So that could be key, especially if it means that the Rangers can then roll three lines effectively. So that's big, especially as Tapo Tato continues to be out on the COVID list, as T'Andre Miller continues to be out on the COVID list, as Jacob Trouba continues to be out with a broken thumb, as Panarin continues to be on his leave of absence. The Rangers need to get bodies back. They're not losing fringe players, 7th defensemen, 13th forwards. That's not who's coming off the roster on a seemingly nightly basis. They're losing players out of their top part, out of their core of the lineup, and that's a problem. Dan, I'm going to place you in GM Jeff Gordon's shoes for a minute. And Jeff, if you're listening, don't worry, Dan doesn't actually want your job. What moves, Dan, would you make to try to get this team to at least tread water, if not more, until reinforcements can arrive naturally?
I mean, the move that I would make is no move, actually. I think that you have to... I know that GMs don't want to hear this. I know that big executives don't want to hear that this is a difficult season and that this is going to be too much to overcome. But ultimately, you have to understand this is a team that's building. You don't want to disturb anything. We've seen some good things from the young guys. We've seen some good things from Miller. We've seen some things from Fox that are really good. You don't want to disturb that in any way. And I understand wanting to bring something earlier, but ultimately you've got to continue to let the core fester, kind of come together.
It's true. You do need to let the core fester, although I don't know that I would completely be against bringing in a stopgap measure. Not that there's really any stopgap measures on the market at the moment, but it bears watching.
And it's not a good move to overpay for something. It's not a good move to go out of your way to get something if it's not there.
Well, they can't overpay. They can't overpay anyway right now. They're up against the salary cap almost. But in positive news, a former Ranger is working his way back. We don't know if he's going to continue his NHL career or not. If he does, it would be nothing short of miraculous. Henrik Lundqvist, who's currently under contract with the Washington Capitals, he was back on the ice the other day working out, not with the team or anything, but back on the ice working out just 2 months after heart surgery. Dan, you or I, 2 months after heart surgery, would probably still be laying in bed pleading for someone to take care of us. The fact that Lundqvist is back on the ice, even just skating and taking, you know, soft shots just to get his body moving, is nothing short of fantastic.
And again, this is a story that goes beyond hockey. And obviously, everybody in the world wants to see Henrik Lundqvist on the ice. There's nobody.
They don't just want to see him on the ice. They want to see him hoisting the Stanley Cup.
I want to see him in Madison Square Garden again to give him the ovation that he deserves at some point.
I'll be doing the Eddie O chant.
But this is, more importantly, it's about recovering from this heart condition, which apparently he's been dealing with for years. And 2 months later, seeing him skate, that's such an encouraging sign. And again, with all this negativity surrounding it, I couldn't have been happier to see this great news.
And again, our thoughts go out to Henrik Lundqvist and his family as we continue to wish for a speedy recovery for the former king. Actually, let's be honest. He's always going to be the king of New York.
Always, always.
We're now going to move into yet another story that transcends sports right now. And that's what the Yankees are dealing with pitcher Domingo Herman. In 2019, towards the end of the season, CeCe Sabathia was hosting his annual charity event, and Domingo Herman, inexcusably, he slugged his girlfriend in front of multiple teammates, and their wives, and members of the team's organizational staff. And give them credit, Dan, no one hid, no one ran, they bore witness, they reported to team brass. No one tried to hide behind the, well, he's our teammate, we have to, you know, stand up for him. They came out, legitimately tried to control the situation, tried to report it, tried to do the right thing, put Herman and his girlfriend in separate cars to go home. Herman's girlfriend later called the player's wife to come save her while she was barricaded in the bathroom. that player's wife and the player came to settle down the situation. Ermine was later suspended for the playoffs and all of last season. He's back now, and it doesn't sound like a lot of his Yankee teammates are too thrilled with him.
And how can they be? So this is a very different situation than a lot of the issues of domestic violence that have come to light. Partly because it was so visible. It almost reminds me of the Ray Rice incident in a certain way because of how visible it was and how much coverage it was and how open it was and what a horrible situation that it was. And ultimately, I understand players like Zach Britton coming out and say, I don't get to pick my teammates.
Well, Luke Voit saying that Adderman's on thin ice if he makes one wrong move.
Now, there is obviously that discussion, and what we do not on this show at all condone what he did. He has come out and said that he is working on this kind of stuff, but again, it's seemingly too little too late, and I don't blame Yankees players for being opposed to him.
It does bring up the question, though. Why was a player like Aroldis Chapman and others, because, you know, we're not to go through the whole list right now, but why was a player like Aroldis Chapman and the others given a second chance with minimal opposition? I'm sure there was maybe some behind closed doors, disgruntlement among players in which on Chapman's teams, on other teams with players that have dealt with this across all sports. Not to say that, you know, just because we don't hear about it in the public that there can't be disgruntlement, because I'm sure there is. But why is it that these players get a second chance with minimal fanfare where Ermine is basically already 1 foot out the door?
Now, I don't want to justify the difference in treatment because I think, obviously, on this show, we condemn all forms of domestic violence regardless of what has happened, regardless of the situation. So I am not saying that this is right, but I think ultimately the reason is because of that visibility. And it's not an accurate way to look at the world. It is a cognitive bias. But ultimately, people who have something happen right in front of them, where something is so visible, are more likely to have a visceral response to it. And I think that's part of the reason. Obviously, Aroldis Chapman has made amends with a lot of what has happened in the past, and hopefully Ermine will find a way to do the same, and will find a way to heal all of the wounds that he created.
I mean, I don't know that he can ever really amend everything and can really fix everything.
Oh, absolutely.
It's something that's going to bear watching this season. The Yankees, look, we're not in the Yankee clubhouse. We're not in the Yankee locker room. We don't know what those are behind closed doors. We can only go by what's being said out in the public by the players. The fact that this is a situation this early in the spring and doesn't really seem to have something that's going to go away anytime soon, it really bears watching, because to be a championship team, which Aaron Boone and the Yankees profess that they are, someone please get Aaron Boone out of office, thank you very much, it bears watching, because you have to have chemistry. You have to be better than the sum of your parts, and if teammates are not thrilled with one of their teammates, in this case Ermine, how are they going to have that chemistry that's going to get them through the hard times, get them through the dog days of summer, get them through the playoffs, and accumulate in a championship that they haven't had since 2009.
And again, one of the things that has been consistently discussed about Aaron Boone is that, yes, he has made some mistakes regarding the bullpen and his game management.
Some?
I was being generous, but the big thing that
too
is
generous.
But the thing that is discussed with him ultimately is this is an elite communicator. This is somebody who was obviously a former player and was a leader in the clubhouse, and as a manager is a leader, and that's what he is going to bring to the table ultimately. This will be his biggest test to see how great a communicator is he. How can he rectify for these people's lives? What can he do that can have an impact on both the Yankees in terms of their play and in terms of their goodwill towards one another?
Again, it bears watching. The Yankees kicked off the spring training slate on Sunday, and we will be tuning in, of course. We'll bring you up-to-date information on that on each show every Friday. We hope to have a lot of baseball-related guests in the month of March, and it's something that's going to be very interesting for the baseball season, as well as especially for the Yankees and the Mets. We are going to move right now into our new and popular segment where we have a fan call in, one lucky fan, to talk about their sports hot take. Daniel, you got us this fan. His name's Aaron Somarov, and he's going to be calling us with what you tell me is a hot take. Hopefully it is. So we're going to connect with Aaron right now, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, Aaron, it's Matt and Dan and Outside the Studio. How are you today?
Great. It's great to be here.
Aaron, it's great to have you on the show. And I know you're one of the biggest Nets fans I know. You're somebody who's loved the team for a long time.
Lifelong.
You've been through all of it. You've been through, you know, Jason Kidd, all those years, all the struggle years. But I want to hear what your hot take is about this newest team.
I mean, I guess this isn't real. I don't know if this really is a hot take.
Don't let us down off the bat. Let us determine that.
I think that this is the best big three we've ever seen. And mainly because all three of these guys are shooting 50% from the field and 40% from three. And all of the best scorers that we've seen of our generation, the T-Macs, the Kobes, the AIs, none of them ever did that. Not in one season of their amazing careers. And the Nets have three players that are doing that, you know, every game now. And I also think that this big three is bigger than the sum of their parts, because Harden and Kyrie are both having the best shooting seasons of their careers. And I got to think it's because of the talent that they're playing with.
And actually, I am going to rate this take mildly hot. I would say that a lot of people would disagree with you, and I myself would still point to those Warriors teams. And I would still look at the fact that Durant, that's the main one. And I would still look at those teams and go, they could score in every way from every part of the court. They won three titles. Now, it was a younger Durant. It was a great team. I think it's hard for any team to ever match that again.
It's not something that we think is going to get matched again. Aaron, I have to ask. You're saying that you think this is the best big three of all time because of the, and you're basically going off of their shooting stats, which, look, I'm not saying that's wrong, okay? You're perfectly welcome to that opinion, and who's to say whether that's not the way to go about it, because how do you judge a basketball player? You judge a basketball player on their efficiency shooting. But in a world where what matters most is championships, for a big three that, look, it is their first year together, so they obviously haven't had the opportunity to play for a championship just yet. How can you logically and reasonably sit there wherever you are right now calling in to say that they are the best big three of all time and they haven't won one yet?
Well, I do think that at the end of the season they definitely will win.
But that's at the end of the season. We're talking about right now.
I mean, right now they're the hottest team in the NBA, and their big three, they've been playing with two out of their three big three. And I also just want to add in that aside from the big three, I think that this is just the best shooting team we've ever seen. Jeff Green is shooting more than 40% from three. Joe Harris is shooting more than 50% from three. When you put that small ball lineup in, it's good night. No team can keep up with them. It doesn't matter that they don't have size. It doesn't matter that they don't have depth at the center position. Now, because at the end of the day, they're going to rain threes and no one's going to be able to keep up with them.
Now, Aaron, I actually have famously said on this show that if this big three and the rest of this team can stay somewhat healthy and can gel together, that they should be the favorites in the finals. But I think the one thing is, although the small ball has been working, we will see how that happens in the playoffs. We'll see how they keep up with a guy like Embiid. We'll see how they keep up with Anthony Davis if he ends up coming back. We'll see how this team performs over the playoffs when depth becomes more important. And Aaron, I'm with you, though. I'm hoping that this big three shows that they're the best by winning the championship.
Look, Aaron, I'm going to give you that they are probably the best shooting team of all time. I'm not going to dispute you there. You showed the numbers. Not going to dispute you on that. I am not going to go along with you just yet on that they're the greatest big three of all time. So I'm going to call this a moderate hot take at the moment. If they win, maybe I'll come around. But right now, I'll give you the fact that they're one of the greatest shooting. I'm not giving that they're the best big three of all time. Thank you, Aaron, for calling us today. And we hope that you continue to listen to Outside the Studio going forward.
All right. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
You're welcome. You too. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our lucky fan of the week. And then, You seem to be standing up for our guests a little bit more than, you know, maybe you should be, I think.
Our guests are kind. Our guests are very intelligent and work very hard to come on this show. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage, which is why, of course, I encourage anybody who's listening right now who wants to be heard on the show to contact us on social media going forward. I think that Aaron brought up a lot of good points. And, man, I mean, I watched that game against the Magic last night. Now, I know that it's the Magic and that ultimately this is not a good team. But, again, just always with this team, you just wonder, how is somebody going to stop them? How is somebody going to stop this scoring? I'm so excited by what we're seeing out of Brooklyn right now.
Well, it's something that's going to, as I keep saying, it's going to bear watching, because we're going to have an interesting fall, an interesting spring, an interesting summer, and an interesting winter all coming up. So New York sports is definitely a place to be at right now. Dan, before we go off the air today, I want you to say something. We're not going to argue it right now. We're going to argue it next week. What is, in your opinion, the single most exciting type of play in professional sports?
So we're giving a little bit of a cliffhanger. I love that. So in terms of the most exciting play in professional sports, I'm going to have to go with a baseball play, and I'm going to have to go with the inside the park home run. This is something.
Now, is it just a regular inside the park home run? We need specifics here. Is it just any inside the park home run? Is it a walked off? Is it a grand slam inside the?
What is a grand slam inside the park home run? This is the big thing. Any inside the park home run is the most exciting thing that you see. It's a guy hitting the ball, a lot going on in the outfield, and somebody going at 120% around the bases. I don't know what could possibly be more exciting than that. And, boy, I hope we get to see some of those this year.
Well, I was going to pick the walk-off inside the park home run, but thanks for ruining that for me. So I guess just for the sake of being different, I'm going to have to go with a multiple overtime game-winning walk-off goal in hockey in the playoffs. There's nothing better than live hockey, especially in the playoffs, and to see these players go through a war of attrition and score a goal in the third overtime period, let's just say, there's nothing better except maybe having, you know, some fluids afterwards. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to leave you with that today. If you miss our live show, you can catch the recordings on NewYorkExtra.com, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes and Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud. Please tune back in next Friday, March 5th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for more Hot and Cold Tapes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blittner. To my left is co-host Daniel Green, saying thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed our theme song by Jessica Page DeMary, please visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for a full works. And we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.